Andrew, over to you.
Graham, thanks very much. I'll just try and turn camera on. There we go. I presume I can see myself, so I presume everybody can see me. Graham, yes. Can you just... Yep, okay. So, well, welcome everybody to the first session of this year's Connections. And it's nice to say this year's Connections in a way that feels very familiar. As Tom and Graham both alluded to, and Kira earlier on, 2013 when we first started, and there was, with a degree of encouragement from the greats like Peter Perler, there was, as Tom said, a degree of sort of apology, let's see where we go with this, Phil Sabin in the background saying, I'm sure we can make a success, but a degree of skepticism. And isn't it good that, is it 9 years on, we're still going strong? And it's worth saying to both Graham and Tom, thank you very much for that, because it's you two that have absolutely been the driving force behind this. So thank you. Thank you all for attending. We've got the best part of 80-odd people in this conversation already, which is really good. And it is worth just reinforcing those comments that have already been made about the traction that wargaming is really beginning to get. A forgotten art, an apologist's art. We've now got, as you've heard, NATO deeply involved in working out how they can use wargaming much better. But within the UK, the new CGS is absolutely an advocate of wargaming. He understands the value that I'll speak about in a moment. The new commandant of Sandhurst is absolutely, Zach Stenny, absolutely a convert, not quite messianic, but not far off in terms of the value of wargaming. And the Secretary of State, as you have heard already, and we'll hear in a moment from Ben, is absolutely a convert. You put all that together and that energy is beginning to get some results. As one illustration, the Army Generalship Programme, run every year for the new... For the new two stars, I'm getting feedback in the background.
That was just someone who popped up and is gone. Don't worry.
Oh, okay. the Army Generalship Program, now running for some 7 years or so, for the new two stars. This year, we will be running for them a one-day war game. As part of CGS's direction in Operation Mobilize, that everybody must be focusing not on everything that they do, not just on the specifics of whatever course that they are running, but on how you operationalize your role. So that's a really good step in the right direction. A quick intro of myself. I'm Andrew Sharp. I'm a retired soldier. 12 years or so now retired. I have a PhD from Cambridge in strategic leadership, and I run a portfolio career, amongst which is the director of the Centre for Historical Analysis and Conflict Research for the Army. But importantly, I've also been a lifelong wargamer and a profound believer in the practicing of execution. And of course, a colleague of Graham's, I guess Graham now, for some 25 or 30 years. And both Graham and I believe that armies, not just ours, and I guess navies and air forces too, tend to practice process and procedure. But war, and it's not just Clausewitz that tells us, war is all about active opposition, stuff going wrong, luck, as the Russians have learned, overestimating your own logistic capability, etc., etc., not just about the neatness of planning and the approval of the person marking that plan. And wargaming, it seems to me, has always been able to offer training, education, experimentation, but also really importantly, the ability to properly test plans through into execution and get people not only used to executing, but test their plans in a way that unpicks all of those hidden things. So headlines for this first couple of hour session. This is, as you've heard, the professional industry panel. We'll start off with an MOD view. We'll then get some views from the experts on what is going on now, and hopefully a view into what could be going on. And then we'll move into a Q&A. Everyone on the panel will have the video on, but the mic's off whilst we're going through the panel. I can't see the chat. So during the Q&A, I would prefer if you do the yellow hands up and I can come to you. If Graham spots any particularly meaty questions in the chat, which, as I say, I can't see, he'll zap me a quick nudge and we can go to those. But could you please do the hand up and then I can come to you. When you do come to Q&A, if you could certainly put your mic on, but it would be nice if you could put your vid on as well so that we can see the questioner, if you don't mind doing that. That would be good so that we get a good interaction in the Q&A. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Ben Moores to kick us off, who's the Procurement and Policy Advisor to the Secretary of State. He'll be followed by Carl Gorton from QTSL Kinetic, who's the Industry Tech Wargaming Lead for Astrid, amongst other things. Then Des Fitzgerald, who's a self-employed consultant, works for Satira in this context. Gordon Pendleton, a Managing Director of Cordillera. And then we'll hear from Ivor Gardner by recorded video, because although Ivor is with us, the link is a little bit wobbly with him at the moment. And once we've had a conversation with them for probably about an hour in terms of what they have to say and then some questions for me, we'll then go over to you, the audience, to ask them questions. So that's it from me to kick off. I'll now hand over first to Ben Moores. Ben, over to you.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, good morning, everybody. 3 years ago, I was given an insight into how serious the Secretary of State was about wargaming, when after sending him a very casual connections invitation, his team called me to tell me he was actually en route. A slightly panicky moment ensued as we tried to figure out what we did next. But in the event, I know that the Secretary of State found the whole experience especially instructive, and it gave him real confidence in the community here today. For those who don't know me, I'm Ben Moores. I am the Secretary of State's Procurement Advisor. I'm also a wargamer, having stumbled across the Osborne battle books back in the 1980s. I'll play anything from mega games to video simulations. I've built some mega games. I was a lead beta tester on all the early Paradox games. The Secretary of State sold me on the role I have now on the basis of come and join me and you can do all that wargaming stuff you like, but for real, I need you to help me implement challenge in defence. So on taking up the post of Secretary of State, Ben Wallace immediately identified that we were not focused on the threat and that and the challenge that was required. Subsequently, he has relentlessly pursued that goal. He's devouring defence intelligence, driving through the setting up of SONAC, his personal strategic analysis body, changing procurement requirements and cancelling platforms in order to fund enablers. And then subsequently, as has been mentioned a few times already this morning, CGS's RUSI speech this summer was clear that we have to mobilise. The threat has come into clear focus and it isn't going away. And whilst the direction of travel now is much clearer, there are a new set of problems to tackle. And for the Secretary of State, wargaming is a key part of how we improve our leadership in order to deal with this threat. Under his leadership, wargaming, combining force testing and OA, has moved from a periphery, the Cinderella of a department at our level, to centre stage. I can think of many moments, including one urban war game that has had a significant impact on a large Ukrainian investment. And only yesterday, he was asking at the very highest levels in defence about wargaming outcomes. Seniors have learned that you're more likely to get his attention with a war game than a photo opportunity. At the same time, we need to go further. Secretary of State is clear that wargaming is not being fully utilised. We've seen people reject wargame outcomes when they threaten their specialist branch. We have also heard others in the MOD say that they don't do wargames, as that's something for DSTL to do. I've also heard others say that some of the wargames they participated in were not engaging or an effective use of their time. For far too long, the wargaming community and the skill set has survived through a small band of dedicated individuals. But that's not enough, and there needs to be a change. When I recently spoke to Secretary of State about this event, he couldn't be clearer. Wargaming was not to be buried away in our science labs or innovation centres or in military academies, but to be a fundamental part of our day-to-day leadership and innovation culture. He believes that wargaming should drive innovation, improve leadership, and inject realism into our planning assumptions. As a result of that, the Secretary of State has now formally directed the long-delayed implementation of defined wargaming ownership within the MOD, wider access to training, and the creation of wargaming facilities outside of DSDL. The details of this will be announced in coming months. This is not an examination or an assessment, but it's an actual implementation with money. Now, this will build the framework that will support bottom-up change for this community. But the truth is that delivering this cultural change requires buy-in from all of you. In particular, I believe there are three actions we can all take to drive that change. Firstly, keep evolving. Harness change from a wider community. Innovation, mechanics, and approaches from a wider, diverse gaming community make games more accessible and engaging and can win over the most skeptical and time-restricted of audiences. Secondly, keep being kind. The people we want to win over are often afraid to fail or look bad within their own branch. Many of them don't get a second chance. Kill them with kindness, not rules or implementation, and have them become the advocates for wargaming innovation within their own branches. And finally, keep communicating, or should I say connecting. Wargaming requirements are a complex business, and we need to work together to take advantage of opportunities. For my own part, I'm always happy to facilitate, support, or just be added as a CC on an email chain to get some traction. In the meantime, good luck, and thank you very much today for listening.
Brilliant. Ben, thanks very much. That's a great intro from the desk, beside the desk at the top. And let's all keep our fingers crossed that Ben Wallace stays Secretary of State. My understanding of the situation is that that's almost certainly the intention. But let's pray that that is so. It just strikes me that not the key point, because there were an awful lot of key points in that. But your safe to fail point is a really good one. Military officers, whether they're at sea, in the air, or on land, tend to have very few opportunities to practice their art in terms of execution. Big exercises at Battis or now Oman or whatever tend to be those, or Kenya, tend to be those sort of seminal moments of practice. And it's a one-off, and it has to go well, and it's normally in front of the brigade commander or whatever. And it's not safe to fail. And so people tend to stick to a dance routine that they know will get ticks in the right boxes and not take risks, not try and win in the way that you ought to in war. And wargaming in all its guises give people the opportunity to do that, redo that, and do it again. So, Ben, that's a great hook for us to start the day's conversation with. Thank you very much for that. Okay, I'm now going to ask Carl Gortman. By the way, the bios for everybody are on tab number 3 on that Google sheet that you've all got. So if you want to check out people's full details, just click on that tab and then click on the name. So I'm now going to ask Carl Gortman from QTSL Kinetic to give us his view as the industry tech wargaming lead from his desk about what's going on now in his world, what he can offer and what he is offering. Carl, over to you.
Thank you, General. Good morning, everybody. Carl Gorson, I'm the ASTRID Technical Lead for Wargaming. My background is military originally, moved to NSC, that then became Kinetic Training Simulation Limited. And the technical lead role is part of a sort of portfolio of tasks and projects that I'm involved in. ASTRID itself, for those who are not familiar, is a MOD framework to deliver wargaming through and in support of DSTL, multi-million and multi-year. So it is significant. My role within that, my primary role, is to develop industry in support of their wargaming activities. So to develop industry wargaming capability. First of all, my first sort of area to look at is what is the current ask on industry. I would say at defence level, it's very difficult to get a clear picture of the totality of wargaming and how it is applied. Even harder, therefore, to establish future requirements and the needs of defence to ensure that industry can morph, recruit, or get the capabilities and capacity for a demand signal that, of which we are currently unaware. That said, within the ASTRID framework, and ASC before that, we have increasing clarity. But ASTRID is predominantly land focused. But I look across the piece, and we have, or I am aware of wargaming in MOD, and particularly with SONAC at the joint level, whether it be threat or technology related, supporting current operations, procurement, experiments, etc., etc. But equally down at the single service headquarter level, the two star functional commands within, they're conducting war games, as indeed are the warfare centres. And that doesn't even begin to start looking at how wargaming is applied at formation and unit level. So from a defence perspective, wargaming techniques are applied in a wide number of contexts. ASTRID is primarily analytical in support of DSTL. But although we have the DSTL Wargaming Centre, and it does act as a hub, it is but one of the hubs, with the commercial means by which all those organisations can get industry support for their wargaming being as diverse as the wargamings themselves. So very difficult to get a very clear picture of how wargaming is applied across the totality of defence. But I do understand, obviously, where it sits in the analytical side in support of DSTL. The second point is one on culture and relations. Until recently, it has been highly transactional. A task has been requested, industry has supported, delivered. That contract, if you like, is then completed, and we wait for the next one. Demand recently has increased significantly, and in tandem with that, behaviours are changing, cultures are changing as well, and I'm certainly seeing a marked change towards partnership behaviours and mutual understanding, working through both industry and MOD issues to try to achieve the core role, which is delivery of highly effective and competent war games. However, we are increasingly constrained by diaries, as Graham said earlier. The same people are being used, but they're being used more frequently. We're also constrained by the technology applied. So within DSTL, they have a number of tools, and individuals wargaming in support of DSTL need to be highly conversant with those tools, so they're not focused on botanology, they're focused on the analytical requirements of the game. So combine those, there is a cultural and indeed a commercial bar to growing industry capability that we need to address. We are looking at that and more on that in the second part. But I do believe that a cultural shift is fundamental to industry's ability to morph and change and meet that future demand signal. Staying on the subject of diversification, also sectors and topics. So wargaming techniques are being applied outside defence and the traditional defence spheres. And outside defence, and I'm primarily thinking about national security, so CNI, cyber, health, rail, etc., etc. The term wargame itself presents a cultural barrier, notwithstanding, as mentioned by Ben, if you think defence has fear of safe failure, then try some of those other sectors. But the interconnectivity with defence is ever greater. Technology is driving that as much as anything else, but also how defence conducts operations. And therefore, it is my own belief that we should seek to expand our pool of wargamers to people that don't have a defence background and don't have an MOD background, and look at some of those other sectors and see what they can bring to support our community. And that in itself, I think, would be a longer term benefit to defence. So what are we doing? Currently, there is quite a bit of work on the pipeline and trying to DSTL is taking great steps, it must be said, to provide sufficient commercial assurances that enables us to grow the capability in the wargaming sector. We're also looking at upskilling. We're being provided with train the trainer packages for some of their tools, which we can then pass on to the wargaming community so that they can become available to support wargames involving those tools. There is a bit of work ongoing at the moment on skills mapping. We're aligning ourselves to DSTL terminology and doing a translation exercise so that we can see where those that support the Astrid framework in particular sit from one end of the swim lane, being an expert wargame designer, to the entry level, and defining what those are and where we have our people currently. From that, we will then look to identify significant gaps and take proactive steps to address those. This piece of work will also enable us to, once we know what work is coming, to progress individuals within that swim lane by providing them with the right experience and the right exposure to develop as individuals, because I think that's important as well. The overall aim is to increase, as I said, industry wargaming capability to support DSTL. So, as I said, the demand is increasing, and that is putting pressure on both organisations and individuals. So I am open to both organisations and individuals for conversations to join the Astrid community. We have some immediate next steps, and I'll come back to those in the next phase of the panel, and look forward to any questions during Q&A. So, General, thank you very much.
Carl, thank you. I think what strikes me most of all in all of your comments there is particularly following on from what everybody's been saying in the lead up to those comments, which is renewed enthusiasm from all quarters, senior and otherwise. I think there's a bit of a clarion call there for capacity, isn't there? It's industry needs to understand that if this is one of those pivotal moments, to quote Graham from his opening remarks, then industry's ability to meet that demand in as many imaginative, convincing, useful ways as possible, when somebody senior says, I'll tell you what I think would be a good idea, industry needs to be able to say, yeah, well, we can do that for you, and mean it, instead of, we can do that for you, now we'd better trundle away and work out how we possibly meet that. So that's a very interesting, that's another interesting hook for us to just think about as we move through this panel. Great. Carl, thanks very much. Next up, Des Fitzgerald, talking on behalf of Soteria. Des, over to you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good morning. Is it possible I can share my screen? I don't know if I get permissions because I've got one slide. But anyway, if someone can sort that out, that'd be great.
Hi, Des.
Yeah, okay, great, thanks. Is that... Anyway, not to worry. Right. So Des Fitzgerald, and working or representing Soteria this morning. What I'm going to talk about mainly is the activity that Soteria is involved in. It's mainly land tactical level activity. A lot of our work is via the Land Warfare Centre. And if I just sort of go through some of the things we're doing. So concepts and doctrine development. So things like the Strike Brigade project, which was a couple of years, Urban Line, which was a 2-year series of war games from battle group to brigade. And indeed, we ended up doing core level as well with the ARC. And that's multiple different types of battle groups and brigades. And those war games, we used their what we would call an execution war game. So as Andrew mentioned at the start, the Army's really good at planning, but actually taking a plan and then running it through a proper execution war game. And the outcome of that was it was to generate discussion. So the object of the war game is not who won or lost, but actually gathering the insights from that activity. And so it's the vehicle for discussion. And that worked, I believe, effectively, and there is still a demand for that kind of activity. So that's been useful. The threat TTX, tabletop exercises, this is something we're in the second year of rolling out now. It's focused on low level at battle group, and tomorrow we're taking some subunits through. It's a tabletop exercise. So literally they get a brief on the enemy threat. And I'll just say that it's the current threat that we're all thinking about, looking at their behaviors. And then we take them through on a simple scenario with a map, some counters. There's no operational analysis. We literally just use military judgment. So you get people to lay things out and then say, okay, if you do that, what does that look like? And that again is extremely effective. It's very cheap. It can be done in briefings in the morning and a couple of hours with a map and a few counters, and it's great value. The counter ISR, counter intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance course, they asked us to design a war game. So shamelessly, we stole Ivor Gardner's Kriegspiel rules. We simplified them down for what we needed. And we run that now as a steady drumbeat of, I think it's about 6 courses a year. Courses are about 24 students. And so we run 4 tables. So 2 people play blue, 2 people play red. And that's a really useful, it's a Kriegspiel, so it's a double blind war game. And you actually start to understand deception and concealment and all these other kind of issues that in an open war game aren't considered. And we've now had units, I think, down in the arms, and they're now looking to try and develop that and run something similar for some of their for their courses. So that's useful. And also support to operations. Myself and another colleague, Paul Beebs, who some of you may have know, we've been out already to war game a plan for a particular operation, and we're going to be invited back later on. So there's definitely demand out there, and we're finding requirements for war gamers to be exploited and used by defence. Where are we now in terms? I mean, the actual core war game team for Soteria, which is, it's a raft of people like me, individuals generally who have left the army. So unfortunately, in demographic terms, we tend to look a bit like me with short hair. Some of us grow beards to look slightly different. But essentially, the core war game element is probably 3 or 4 of us. And then you have peripheral people around it, some of whom are getting this, and we're trying to develop and bring them on, certainly through the TTX process. That's like an entry level, if you like. It's a good way of getting them in. So we're using that. In terms of attitudes that I've noticed over, I've been doing this now for about 7 years, and attitudes range. So when you meet up with a military audience at the start, you often get, oh, this is just it's going to be a course of action war game, which they all do, and we can discuss that's not actually a war game, but park that. So there's a bit of, oh yeah, we know what this is, to folding arms, and yeah, I'm not really going to enjoy this. During the actual execution, once the first thing often is people getting surprised at how quickly their plan falls apart. And that is not through us being clever. When we brief, when we have, for example, my colleague Paul Beeves will play red, he will explain very carefully at the start what red will do in capabilities. And it's quite interesting how many people then ignore that and then do whatever they want to do and expect red to follow their sync matrix, which is, you know, a sync matrix is just an engineering Gantt chart. It just tells you how you're going to sequence things. Red doesn't have a copy and therefore isn't constrained by it. So often the first thing is surprise, a bit of shock. Sometimes it's a bit uncomfortable, particularly when senior commanders, either commanding officers or brigade commanders, suddenly find their plan is falling apart. But generally, after they've been through that process, at the end of it, they see the value and they understand, ah, yes, this was actually really quite useful. And we've had a number of units now that we're almost repeat visitors because we've taken them through operations in forests. They then got a turn on the Urban Lion, and then they want us to come out and do something else. And so we actually have COs trying to get hold of us if we're available. Because they can see the value of wargaming. And What I would say is we get this from the military contractor, because we say to them, look, you should be able to do this yourself. And they say, well, we can't. And it's not just SQEP. It's not just the experience and expertise. There is a little bit, but it's not massive, because most of what we do is military judgment. But it's just having an external individual, an external organization who is not part of the chain of command, who can just come in there and again, there's no reputational harm. And that's, I think, possibly one of the issues that people have. And that, I think, is probably all I need to say, if you're happy, Andrew.
Yeah, great, Des. Thanks very much. I mean, there's a stream of consciousness there with a number of lights going blip, 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 one of which let's explore in the Q&A, I think, on attitudes, because that's a hardy perennial on connections, but is worth coming back to. I think a couple of things, though, just worth stressing. One is the point that essentially you're closing with, that war surely is sure. It's about, you know, it's not about the plan. It's about the planning and getting all that right. But those who are good at war tend to be those who are best after execution has started, not in both senses, not before. And being able to practice that, being able to practice it time and time again, is really important. I'm sure we'll come back to that. But the one thing that really struck me right early on in your remarks was talking about, I make no apology for stealing Ivor Gardner's Kriegspiel, the Camberley Kriegspiel from Chaser. Absolutely. And we shouldn't be apologising for it, because the more tools we can use that are immediately familiar, then we're going to get ourselves out of that space that you've just described, as where they throw up their hands and say, we can't possibly do this for ourselves. And I mean, the analogy that I use is it's like every unit saying, I'm sorry, we can't do unit football this afternoon because we haven't got expert outside help to referee us, to coach us, to tell us how to do it, so we can't play football. Of course they can. They all know how to play football. Some better than others, obviously, if I'm a Mercian, then, you know, obviously we play football better than anybody else. But you know what I mean. There's this bizarre, this is something for experts only mindset that we do need to get past. And one of the best ways of doing that is to stick to as many familiar tools as we can to get ourselves into a place where people feel they can do it for themselves. Great, thanks, Des. That was an awful lot of stuff to get our teeth into. Gordon, I'm going to hand over to you. And in so doing, I think I'm just going to turn my vid off for a moment, because I can see the bandwidth struggling with both of us. So I'll just hand over to you. I'm still here, but I'll just turn my vid off and over to you.
Thanks, Andrew. Can you see my slides?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. So good morning, everybody. I'm Gordon Pendleton. I'm the Managing Director of Cordillera Applications Group. I've got four slides to show you, and I'll just go through them quickly. Can somebody move the slide on for me? I can't get permission to move on.
No, that's your end, Gordon. You might need to come out of the show.
It's all right.
That's it.
It's just released. Thanks ever so much indeed. Okay, so I'll just give you a quick background from where we come from, so you understand why we're in the wargaming market and what we've done. We're a research and operations company, mainly with worldwide clients. We've got a company based in US and also the UK. We work closely with the World Bank, NATO, DARPA, the City of Norfolk on an urban resilience project, the Australian Defence Force, MOD here, and also DSTL. Our company CEO is Dr. David Cullen, the well-known author, and our wargaming concept development, experimentation, and operational analysis capability is applied both to the commercial and military sectors, which provides us with some interesting aspects when we're looking about delivering wargaming, and also the use of the word wargaming. We provided Matrix wargaming services and COA development wargaming services across the piece to the military. And we're very interested in modeling and simulation as a support tool to wargaming. Most of our SMEs are urban SMEs and urban littoral SMEs, and we also delve quite heavily into the multi-domain market. Okay, so what can we as wargamers add to the client, and why should the client be interested in what we deliver? So we design and deliver future capability wargaming to NATO, as I said, ADF and the Royal Marines. We deliver strategic, operational and tactical level wargames. So that in its way, as you just heard from Des, creates a problem because tactical wargames are quite different from strategic level wargaming. I think it's critical to deliver any of this with to have a good understanding of what concept development and experimentation is. And I believe there's a question out there at the moment about experimentation. And I think it's really interesting if you approach it from an experimental point of view and look how we can do wargaming from that point of view. Our wargames for NATO are mostly in the urban and urban littoral environments. That's quite understandable given what's going on in the East at the moment, but that's been bubbling along since about 2013. So we've been looking at this since 2013. I think the most important lesson we've learned from the urban and urban littoral work is you need to be aware of developing an existing city technology developments, as well as the urban NATO tactics. It's a combination of both, and we were very lucky on the NATO projects to be able to reach out to universities around the world and talk to them, particularly architects, city designers, and understand a city, how it lives, how it breathes, and what it does. And I think that's really important when you're trying to deliver wargaming, that you just don't approach it from a military point of view. The other thing we found out with wargames, they're always joint now, and increasingly multi-domain. So it's all well and good to do a tactical level land war game, but we're asked more and more now, and what's the so what? And then we go to air land domain, and then people say, yeah, and so what? So we've found that to get war game SMEs, which are very difficult to find in airspace, maritime, cyber, and land, are increasingly important for war game provision. And as we sort of expand the conversation today, we need to think about who we bring in and from what skill set that they come from, not just a military background. We spend a lot of time as a company looking into military and civil publications for future technologies and capabilities. And the reason we do that is we need to bring the generation after next understanding to wargaming concept development. And again, I think that conversation needs to be had today. It's not just about now. Now is important, but how do we integrate future technologies? Kinetic produced a fantastic magazine that looks out 10 years at technologies, and it's really interesting read, and it really expands your knowledge of what's out there. And there's some really good military publications like Jane's Defense News that also sort of look out the next 10 years and also look at how we can do modeling and simulation to support wargaming. Urban and urban littoral wargames need non-military input. We've been very lucky with the NATO wargames. We've run about 20 of them now. We've been able to include city planners, local government, emergency services, UN and NGOs. And I think that echoes Graham's comments and Andrew's comments at the beginning of the session to actually talk about how we can bring other people from other walks of life into wargaming. And whether we call it experimentation or wargaming should be considered. And then capacity and capability. So we hear time and time again, there's a significant lack of wargame SMEs with multi-domain understanding. So we need to find them and we need to train them. And it's not just we need to train them in wargaming, we need to understand what the client wants from us so we can present that red challenge that Des just articulated really well. What is that red challenge that we're going to give within the wargame? And those analysts and the SMEs, they need to have strong convictions, and they also need to speak with authority. And that background doesn't necessarily need to be from a military audience. The analysts in our team will tell me all the time that you write the scenario to draw out the aims and objectives and get the analyst analysis that you require to put in the report. A lot of people write the scenario first, and then we go into the analytical part of the war game. I find it's very rare to get really good with an understanding of combat modeling. And again, I think that conversation needs to be had as part of the war game debate. We're currently working with NATO to design a wargaming course with appropriate accreditation. That's been a long process, a good talk. We're looking at very closely how we do that. There is a demand, and we heard there's a demand from NATO, and we need to fill that demand. And it doesn't necessarily need to be from military audience again. I think it's key that we identify the correct skill set and then train in the wargaming technique. There's plenty of skill set out there, but we just need to be open-minded to who we bring in. Again, with the NATO wargaming, we've been very lucky to be able to bring in university students, young people who have got engineering, space, autonomous systems expertise to support the wargame. And they plan, and we also plan to do the same in the future. We're lucky NATO has a budget to allow to do that. We've reached into a broad range of universities, and it's amazing how much support they're willing to give you and train their young people. And it's, we're not talking about professors, we're talking about young people experimenting with new systems. And that's fantastic to have that in with a military balance. Modeling and simulation expertise support is important to wargaming, but it's also important to remember that MNS is a support to the wargame, not the other way around, which is very easy to do. And I find a lot of people get carried away with modeling and simulation. It's needed because that's what people expect now, but it's a support tool to the wargaming. Then Andrew and Graham both asked me to talk about attitudes that we experience when we're doing the wargame. So a couple of the classic things that we've experienced before delivery or during the build up to the wargame. We find that attitudes vary based on the engagement you have with the sponsors. It's very important that you get face to face in a room with the sponsors at an early stage and understand what they want and you, your ability to give them your experience to achieve what they want to do. The cost of the event is hugely important. We can't hide from that. And it's the perceived value for money of wargaming. And that is a barrier that we always have to break through. People say, I've got this budget. And you have to make sure that they understand what you deliver is perceived value for money. And the other critical thing before delivery is the time you're taking with the wargame team away from their day job. You can help them. It's important to help them. But it's really important to understand you're taking them away from a day job and you need to work hard on it. Also, the attitudes during a war game, we've always found generally extremely positive. We tend to work in a multinational environment and a military and a non-military environment just because of the type of war games that we deliver. So we've found that across the board, we get an extremely positive feedback during a war game. But that is built on having time to train the audience in what you want to achieve from the war game. We always have a day and a half training. It's a cost. The people who are investing in that, the sponsors, don't often like that cost, but we spend a lot of time pushing them to do that. We use video to put people into a future environment to help. It's critical that the audience understand and need to buy into what you're doing and what you're trying to achieve. And I think that's good, and it helps the attitudes during the war game. Again, post-attitudes, nearly always positive. Perceived cost benefit, again, is important. No matter what you do, if you don't deliver on cost and benefit and give a good report, you lose the sponsor and you lose their will to do further wargaming. And on that, I'll end, Andrew, and back over to you.
Gordon, thanks very much. As with everybody else, there's a number of things struck me as you were going through that. I think one, because so much of what you do is urban centric. It's a generic point on militaries and urban. I've now I guess, heard repeatedly from commanders of the field army, from assistant chiefs of the general staff, from chiefs of the general staff, and indeed throughout the joint environment, that, you know, urban warfare must be our main effort. But very quickly they default to the, but it's all too difficult, isn't it? Because it's complicated, because it needs all of those elements that you've discussed, and therefore shy away from it in all of its guises, in all of its training, experimentation, planning, and educational senses. People tend to shy away from it, and yet they keep saying it's an unavoidable main effort. So that's perhaps worth returning to. Interestingly, the what's in a name that you raised, calling it wargaming itself, is an issue. The first question that we were asked in the chat, I understand, because I can't see the chat, but was on exactly that subject. So clearly people are interested in that. We might like to return from that. But perhaps linked to it, perhaps not, is your penultimate point about not being able to find the time and the capacity, value for money, absolutely. But surely my point from earlier on is this should not just be a value for money external thing, but it should be something that could be, you know, DIY. Soldiers don't expect externals to come and run a range day for them. It's a basic infantry skill that every infantry unit, because it needs to be able to shoot straight and has since arquebuses and muskets were invented, has the capacity to run its own range day. Well, execution is part of the day job. Training for execution is part of training to be a soldier. So this ought to be something that they don't need to find extra time for. It ought to be core work, and there ought to be a degree of ability to DIY it, some of which comes with expert advice, some of which comes through training with experts and training the trainer, but some of it does need to be self-generating to sit alongside that expert helping hand. Gordon, thank you very much. That I think, added an extra dimension to this morning's discussion. So, Ivor, I guess that you may or may not have the connectivity just to say hello, and then hand over to your recorded video so that we can hear your pitch without fear of it being interrupted by your comms. Over to you, Ivor.
Hello, Andrew. Yeah, thank you. Very poor comms over here. So the pre-recording, I think, is probably the best way forward. Graham, if you've got it ready to go. In fact, where I'm over here, I'm not even managing to see the slides that people are putting up. But my apologies. I'm going to be making apologies again in the recording. I'm not particularly familiar with being on the receiving end of a camera recording. So I think it over-exaggerates various sound effects. So where I sound like I'm having a big sigh, please put that down to the recording. And it's just me inhaling and it being over-elaborated on the recording. But I think rather than take up any time now, I'll come back in for Q&A. And Graham, if you could play the recording, please.
Roger that. So everyone, just give us a minute. We just need to press several buttons to make this work. Fingers crossed. Here we go.
Good morning. My name is Ivor Gardner. I am the Operations Director for Vedette Consulting. And I'm going to start with an apology for the fact that you're watching a recording here and I'm not able to join you live. I'm currently abroad. The place that I'm staying has got extremely poor Wi-Fi connectivity, which I've been trying to sort out for the last couple of days. And this has been my backup to make a recording and send it on to Graham. So if you're watching this, it means I've not been able to connect to the connections. And again, I can only apologize for not being able to be speaking to you in person. I work for Vedette, as I said. I know we're not here to pitch for our individual organizations, but just for a little bit of context, we are primarily ex-forces within Vedette. We do a lot of decision support work for the MOD and other agencies. But this is specifically about, I think, professional support to the military. So I'm going to primarily focus on that element of it and the wargaming side. Now, I am not trying to insult anybody's intelligence by putting in this in here or teach anybody to suck eggs, but I do think part of what we should be discussing here this morning is that element of what should be our unifying purpose. Because so many of us involved in these different industries are ex-forces, we should all be pulling in the same direction. I think we all have a vested interest in the armed forces. We've all been there. We understand what it's like at the coalface. We understand the importance of wargaming to the whole process of delivering military activity. And, you know, really, if nothing else, we know the difference that this can make to those men and women who are deployed, whether they be Navy, Air Force, or Army. So I think we really need to probably define what our strategy is. We need to agree that as part of this conference and how we take it forward. So, you know, we are here, top of the pinnacle. We are trying to get to the top of that next peak there, and then everything in between. So what does that to here look like? Where are we currently? And what's everything look like in between? And I think this is about a coherent long-term course of action. And I think that's something we should be discussing today, that it should be designed to close the gap to that vision. We need to determine what the priorities are, where our intermediate targets lie, what are our ways and means. Ultimately, our strategy has got to be stable in broad terms. And, you know, we live in an ever-changing world. We have to be prepared to adapt to suit our customers, to suit the global position. You know, who would have envisaged a couple of years ago that we would be fighting a war, or that there would be war in Europe again, which may ultimately or may not involve our the forces of our respective nationalities. So we have to be ever evolving and adapting to changing global positions or conditions. So I think just very briefly, ways, means and ends, and I've taken this directly from the from the Army University Press so that we're on the same page. So the ends, the goal, of that strategy, the ways are the actions we need to achieve those ends, and then the means is the resources required to execute that way. So my thoughts on this, and again, there should probably be a question mark behind each of these rather than an emphatic statement, but the ends, are they, from our perspective, a more professional armed forces with a clear understanding of the utility of wargaming in future force development, in capability development, professional development generally, and in force preparation? That's my view, is a yes, but let's discuss. What about the ways? And I think that these ways between us within industry should be as collective and collaborative as much as is feasible. Clearly, you know, we are in industry. It's a business for us, but there's that unifying purpose as well. And this collective action should feed towards that. And our collaborative approach is not just amongst ourselves where we can, but also ultimately with the customer, you know, with the armed forces. So we should be looking, I think, to design and develop war games to meet specific purposes. What is the ask? What is the objective of the customer? Rather than telling them what we think they should have, it's properly understanding what it is that they need. What are the objectives that these war games are going to feed into? And then how we go about facilitating and delivering those war games across the forces. And then finally, the means. And I think this is extremely important here. This is the experienced former military part, because wargaming, if played purely as a game, is not going to present you with feasible lessons. You know, somebody who is purely a wargamer, who's never been a military officer, does not understand force protection measures, the importance of the planning process, how it's done, how the constraints are applied. There are a multitude of factors, all the capabilities on hand. So that experience adds inestimable value, in my personal opinion. However, if you want to get truly quantitative and qualitative feedback from these war games or support exercises, then you need to have people who can do this stuff. You need qualified and experienced analysts. And it's the marrying of those capabilities, I think, where you'll truly add great value. And, you know, it's the development of these bespoke war game systems. You know, this is part of the means. And I think this is an important point to raise. You're going to have discussions with Army officers who might be slightly reticent about wargaming. But I think that happens when they mistake the war game as being the ends here rather than a means to achieving those ends. So, you know, taking this forward then, what is our strategic aim, purpose and vision? And I'm talking about us collectively here. So I'm not speaking to you now as the operations director of Vedette. This is our strategic aim. I'm saying all of us here in this room, all of us who partake within Connections UK and who have a vested interest in the professionalisation of wargaming, and the other elements of it that that inform decision making within the armed forces, you know, what should our strategic aim be? These are my thoughts on a page again. So I see this as being to deliver effective decision support to defence by encouraging a coherent, collaborative industry approach to wargaming activity that fills existing training gaps and, critically here, informs strategic level decision making. So the purpose, again, my views, to enable defence to make sound, informed and timely evidence-based decisions through the coherent development of wargaming, with a vision being an industry motivated to support defence decision making through collaborative interaction, combining military experience and depth to bring wargaming into the professional military. And as I said, that's, you know, discussed. So I thought for this next part here in trying to give my thoughts on this, and, you know, we at VDET have been heavily involved, for example, in the facilitation of TTXs. So matrix war games, seminar war games, that sort of thing. But we, you know, we've done similar sorts of things with the NHS, with other industry and organizations, but specifically here for the military, you know, if we take an approach to this collectively here, you know, what is CTERRA doing? What are Cordillera doing? What is QTSL doing? What are the other agencies and organizations out there doing? How do we bring this all together? And I thought taking a dynamic risk approach to this whole thing might be a sensible way to go forward. So we look at the factor, the what, the observations falling out from it, the so what, and then, you know, the next steps. What does it all mean? So I put together this little table with a few points, and these points are by no means exhaustive at all, and there'll be plenty of others, I'm sure, that people wish to add. So what is the issue? And I'll deal with them one at a time. I think, firstly, the armed forces' attitude towards wargaming, and I'm not going to elaborate here because we've seen so many presentations before. General Andrew Sharp has given many addressing this issue in the past, but just some quick observations. It's misperceptions. There are those who see wargaming as childish, impractical, for which there's no time. There are others who think that because we do COA wargaming in the military, that is what wargaming is all about, so we can all wargame. But it's not. My personal view on this is that COA wargaming is a very effective tool as part of the planning process, but it is a confirmatory tool rather than a pure war game where you're playing against a thinking enemy who's trying to beat you. There's the fear of failure. Some people do not want to execute in their wargaming. They're afraid of being shown up, in which case we have failed to provide that safe to fail environment. And then also some people see time as ill spent on games. There was a planning officer at the Defence Academy some years ago, nobody recent, when we were trying to get the Camley Kriegsspiel into the Defence Academy, who said, I'm here to produce staff officers, not war gamers. Completely missing the point. They're, again, conflating the concept that the war game is somehow the ends. It's not. It's a means to getting there. There should be wargaming. Everything that we do within the military should involve some element of wargaming if there's a decision associated with it. Again, in my view. So what now? What do we do about that? Well, I think we should be looking at how we influence the military mindset. And I believe we should be running a wargaming symposium to kick that off of all leadership groups, starting with the army and then probably expanding into a more joint environment. That we should be engaging more closely in wargaming with NATO and other allies. That we should illustrate the career-enhancing potential of wargaming. And I say this as a commanding officer in my own unit. I used wargaming to develop my young officers. Three of them went off to the Captain's Warfare course and came top of the course. One of them was our RAO, and she, you know, she was not an infantry soldier, but she went and she trumped those in her syndicate who were teeth arms. They had been properly prepared before going on their Captain's Warfare course using wargaming internally within our battalion. Now, what better proof can you provide to young officers that this is beneficial to their career development than that level of evidence? We should look to develop bespoke systems and institutionalize them, and this should start from RMS. And if wargaming is not institutionalized, it's going to only ever be a passion project with certain officers, and it'll wax and wane, and ultimately probably wane. And so that wargaming symposium, and indeed Connections UK 23, I think we should be looking to run at Sandhurst, so that we are clearly embedding the wargaming process within the military academic locations. And, you know, what better place than Sandhurst to commence that? And we're in discussions with the Commandant there about that. Another issue I see is that technology is seen as a nirvana. So all solutions to problems now must be technological, right? But this is expensive. software packages, tie defense to very specific exercise constraints, which many of us will be familiar with. And it allows for multiple points of failure, simple power, you know, the laptops, the computer screens, the software programs, the people to facilitate. These are all points of failure. So what? Well, what about the next steps then? We should be illustrating, all of us should be illustrating the utility, the cost effectiveness, and the accessibility of wargaming. And we can simply do that. We can illustrate innovation through the development of different systems and tying the technological and the data-driven with the manual. You know, there is a synergy between these. Lack of capacity is another one. You know, there have been a lot of personnel cutbacks across the armed forces. Staff generally tend to be overworked and double, triple-hatted. And wargaming falls very low on that priority list. So we must fill that gap, and we must show how and where we can fill that gap and add that value. We're still more cost-effective. You know, industry personnel would only be used as and when required. So we don't come with all the personnel overheads that would be required if these became staff functions. So, you know, we are here. We are there with that background experience, and we're willing to apply it. And we've got to fill those gaps. And my last 2 points then is planning. We do a lot of planning in the military. We just don't do a lot of execute. Now, Eisenhower used to say that planning is everything and the plan is nothing. Without an execute, that plan is never tested, and officers have no sense of what failure looks like or why it happens and what they can do about it. How do you mitigate, you know? So institutional bias applies here. I think it tends to overtake the unknown and the untested. You know, we think we're better than that. We often think, you meet officers who think they don't need to be tried and tested. Or if you tell them a certain outcome, they'll say, well, that wouldn't happen because we'd be better than the opposition. Nobody ever loses a tactical exercise without troops, for example, or a cost anymore. And TES exercises are too infrequent and they're far too resource intensive. I think TTHOM's units are doing them about once every 3 years now. That's not enough. We should be doing this stuff several times a year, this type of planning and execute. So what now? Well, wargaming provides the quickest, cheapest, most practical means to deliver an execution of plans, and that versus a live thinking enemy who's contesting you. So, but this has got to be in a safe to fail environment. We have to remove that fear of failure from this process. And then my final point is that there's a lack of coherence across defense with wargaming. In the time that I've been working as a consultant in the defense space, providing wargaming, tabletop exercises, decision support exercises, I have seen so many revisiting of lessons that have been identified and learned in the past. Why are these things not being recorded? Why they're not being used to inform ongoing force development, for example? It's disparate across defense, is part of the reason. It's very ad hoc in terms of its design, and this leads to a lack of continuity, poor capture of lessons identified. The result of that is that you repeat these activities and there's an unnecessary level of extra effort, and you don't get the results at the end of it. You don't get that output. And there's no institutionalized wargaming in the system, and we've got to recognize the importance of institutionalizing. This needs top level ownership. And if you have that, and young officers coming in can see the utility of it and that it enhances their career development, then the passion will drive it. But it's got to have that top level buy-in first. And I'm talking 3 and 4 star. What now then? So industry should be pooling ideas. We should be talking to each other and, you know, pooling that experience as well. Our military experiences and our wargaming experiences. We must look to try and hold a wargaming symposium for the military at Sandhurst in Q1 or Q2 next year. And this has got to be a precursor to the next connections, because actually the next connections, ideally, we want to be looking to run at RMAS, because if we do it there, we hopefully get more of a buy-in from the professional military fraternity, bringing them into the rest of us that are attending Connections UK. And I would love to see how many people in this audience are UK military, because I've attended some of these in the past where they've been, you know, in the UK, where we've had less UK professional military in the room than we do personnel from other militaries with whom we're allied. So I apologize, that was a bit of a long ramble here. And again, for having delivered it by recording, and I wish I could take part in a Q&A, but I hope there's some food for thought there. And that is me complete, apart from just touching on what I think our next steps will be here. And I'm looking at, you know, how we engage with other industry partners and wargaming activities to identify the overlaps, the synergies, the unnecessary divergence, to build existing relationships, compare notes, scope areas for collaboration, and a couple of pledges. And my first is that we At Vedette, we'll look to plan and coordinate the Army Wargaming Symposium at Sandhurst in quarter one two of 2023, and we're already in negotiations with that. That we will partly sponsor and support the Coordination of Connections UK 2023, also potentially at Sandhurst for quarter three or four of next year, and that we will scope and actively pursue collaborative opportunities. This is with industry, customers alike. And a final point, which is partly what this is all about, that's in helping to engage in developing the next generation of people with a vested interest in developing and delivering professional wargaming. Thank you very much for your attention. That is me complete.
Ivor, thanks very much for the video. I hope that we might be able to include you in the Q&A. We'll see how that goes when the time for that comes. But it seems to me that what you've done in your pitch is you've covered all of the remit that Graham set us. So I'll just come back to that at the end. I mean, a couple of interesting points in amongst that stuck out with me. One is almost at the beginning of your talk, talking about the need to have a collective effort, and goes back to Carl's remarks earlier on about few providers, growing demand. So this is a competitive environment for you, the industry, but actually one in which I think you'll be stronger if you all band together in this and work together in this, rather than if you compete against each other, not least of which because of the interchangeability of offer and so on that we've already talked about. I think the point that you made about the importance of getting across that this is a means to an end, trained soldier, sailor, airman, trained whoever, rather than an end in itself, is really important, because I think that's a big lump of where the barrier is. And then a large part of what you finished with in the last almost third of your remarks are about the practical next steps to take. RMAS, and absolutely a good place to be for all of the right reasons of next generation, but not least of which that you have a commandant that's completely a convert to lead from the front on that. But you took us through a series of look forwards. So what I'd like to do now, before we move on into the Q&A, is have a quick look forward from everybody else. So sort of, okay, in a sentence or two, next steps from my perspective. And maybe if we could just go in the same order that we went before. So Ben, then Carl, then Des, and on through to go to Gordon, just to take us through quick next steps. And then I've got one question before we move into the Q&A. So Ben, any thoughts on next steps?
On the Sandhurst thing, it sounds like a lot of people can speak to Zach, but I'm happy to help in. And I have said I would go down and visit him. So, but I don't want to, you know, drown him in people going, yeah, let's do this. But if anyone needs help, then I'm happy to go and do it. On the recorded lessons point, there is actually a program that's quite far down the road now under Major Charles Williams, which is looking at a lessons learnt repository tool. So I suspect it might even be in place by now, but that is the person to speak to. You need to find out whether wargaming is included, but my understanding is it might be, but it would be worth checking. So those were 2 points. And then the other thing was, I think the other thing was that people tend to assume that we get everything up here. We don't. We just tend to get a lot of bad news about things like asbestos or things going wrong. So if you do have stuff that you produce, please send it to me, because I end up chasing people to send me stuff. We just don't get it. It just gets filtered out completely. Finally, there was a lot of chat about sort of traditional war games types, perhaps because it's comfortable. But problems I'd like to see wargaming applied to that are issue for me are space, infra, digital, and what kind of force mix we need in an age of attritional unmanned ISR. So that was all my points. Thank you very much.
Ben, thanks. So lots of food for thought there. I'm particularly struck by your point of, I think throughout my my career, every time somebody said, this is the sort of issue that would catch the Secretary of State's eye, they've said it in that sort of voice, with a, oh my God, we'd better do something to sort this out before it does catch the Secretary of State's eye, as opposed to, do you know what, this is something the Secretary of State would be really interested in. Your clarion call right from the start was, this is something the Secretary of State is interested in. So front foot engagement, as opposed to only engaging defensively, is a very, very good message. So thanks for that. I think all the other hooks we will have picked up as you went through. Excellent. Carl, over to you for some thoughts on, okay, so so what next to persuade and engage and serve defence?
No, thank you. Very clear from the conversations, but also conversation I'm having elsewhere with a number of people that are here today, is that the increase in demand does require a full industry response. So as was a not appropriate one. So working together is absolutely the way forward and something we need to find the means to do. Within the Astrid industry group, our discussions are sufficiently mature now to bring representatives from across the Astrid community together to exchange some views and try and take things forward rapidly. That could be within the next few weeks, so please watch this space. The medium term, however, is that we industry would be sufficiently, I think trusted is probably the wrong word, but so there is sufficient confidence in industry that we can deliver a DSTL task in isolation. So we're handing the requirement and we deliver the output, and that output is there is faith in that output. So that's where we're aiming. And that involves people, technology, infrastructure, facilities, a number of things that we are all looking at. So with Astrid being a significant hub, I absolutely invite conversations as to how to join that community, whether it be individual level or organisational. And we will continue to try to define those skills and work out how to progress people. Within that, the diversification I mentioned earlier, we do need to find the wargamers of the future as a community. And the best way to do that is to have the body of work that enables that and bring people on in the delivery, but without a reduction in the quality of the output that we deliver. So we will do our best to do that. But I do have a pledge, and that is once we've received the trainer package from DSTL, we, and not taking my tech lead hat off for a moment and back to being QTSL, we will be providing gratis training on those tools across the wargaming community so that people then have the skill set to engage with some of the work that we do. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Carl. And I guess that's the point that we've made a few times now is you know, training the trainer, train people so they've got the tools to DIY. And people start realizing, as Ivor alluded to in his video, you know, if you train your own people and it's at unit level where people begin to generate an enthusiasm, and if they can then get away and do it for themselves, that means that they come to you with a much more open mind. So that's very positive. Excellent. Thanks, Carl. Des, persuade, serve, defence, look forward. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're continuing to obviously engage and hopefully by the activities we do, because they tend to be down at the lower tactical level, it does actually mean it hits the junior leadership, hopefully at a formative stage of their career, not when they're like dinosaurs like myself. So that's something. I think one thing that actually contractors do provide is we provide continuity, because certainly you'll find that after 2 years, most of the officers engaged in something, if it's a headquarters or a big project, have moved on. So actually the contractor provides a useful continuity. I think that's a function. The other bit is coherence as well, is often we will, I'll be doing some work at a land warfare center, and then the next week be doing something with DSTL, and the two haven't spoken to each other for whatever reason. So sometimes we can just help provide that coherence, but it leads to, and I think it's a point that Ivor was making about trying to coordinate demand across defence, because often what happens is people will suddenly go, I'm clearing that week. We're back from work. Let's go and run a war game. And of course, if all five organizations do that at the same time, then with the current pool of industry support and expertise, that means there's a prioritization issue. So if there is some mechanism where between ourselves and defense, we can just try and spread the demand out more evenly, then I think we'll probably give a better service back to defense. And in terms of pledges, Soteria, it's because of the nature of what it is, what we will offer as individuals, though, is expertise. So where we can, we'll come along and help and share what we do. That's all. Over.
Thanks, Des. And I guess it's part of the do-it-yourself point that we've been making, linked to your point about people rotate in and rotate out and move on, don't they? They do, but it goes back to the, you know, running your own ranges or running your own sport. If we can get ourselves into a position where this is a key skill, just a normal piece of an officer or NCO's training skills, so that it's a universal capability, certainly at a lower and simple level to deliver, that would be great. I mean, when we're rolling out the Kriegsspiel, Ivor and I, as we went round units, inevitably finished up with people saying, "That's absolutely brilliant. Thanks very much. What a great day. We'll now be doing this ourselves, I promise you." To which we said, "Great," got in the car and drove away. And within a week, we'd be getting a phone call saying, "Yeah, no, that was fantastic. When can you come back and do it for us again?" Instead of bothering just to sit down and learn the rules themselves and do it for themselves. But that I think is a really important point, and we need to get ourselves into a space where people moving on out of training posts, as if it were a niche thing, is not an issue, because it becomes increasingly a universal skill. Great. Thanks, Des. Gordon, your thoughts?
So our thoughts and our pledges from our company particularly, it was we're actively looking for airspace and cyber SMEs. And we're looking for people with not just military experience, but we're willing to train them in understanding war game. We, particularly from the NATO work we're doing, there is a real drive to have these people, and they're really hard to find. So we are looking for basically anybody from any walk of life with those skill set who is willing to come to war game, be trained by us, and then to add to the pool. And obviously listening to what Carl's been saying, from the Astrid point of view, we're happy to, you know, provide support for any initiative to provide that level of SME pool and training moving forward. So keen to do that, and that's what we're willing to pledge.
Great, thanks, Gordon. And I guess that goes back to my introductory point of, you know, work together. But it's absolutely about gathering as many skill sets in as possible. Particularly, I'm struck by a number of you, as you've talked through, have talked about how easy wargaming, Kriegsspieling can be if it's done in the free play Kriegsspiel sense, using military judgment panels in your words. But actually, if this is urban warfare and all other sorts of aspects of slightly more complicated than a Napoleonic battlefield wargaming warfare, then absolutely having as wide a skill set as you possibly can to be part of that judgment mix is surely a really, really important part of it. Great. Thank you. We're getting a good stream of questions coming in, but there's just one that I would like to ask myself before we then go to those questions. I just observed that Patrick Sanders, when he took over as CGS in his first public address on assuming the post, and when he talked at the RUSI Land Warfare Conference, he talked about Operation Mobilize, and he talked about mobilizing in all of its senses, and explained that this, if you're serious about mobilization, didn't just mean something for those in an army uniform to think about. But it had to be a question of a change of approach, of attitude, of mind, and not just for those in the army, actually not just for those in defence, but through to whole of government, even through to national attitudes. And that's a massive undertaking. But that's what he has said he wants the army to be doing. He wants the army to be influencing in what it does, influencing all of those other levers, defence, government, nation, indeed, to understand what the events of the last 18 months, the last 14 years have meant for us and what we need to think about nationally. How can your industry help us with that? And maybe if we, Ben, I'm going to ask you to go last on this, having heard what everyone else has got to say. But Ivor, if you're able, maybe if we go reverse order this time and go Ivor, Gordon, Des, Carl, and then Ben, and then I'll go to the wider questions and ask anybody who wants to chip in and answer those. So Ivor, are you able to communicate?
Hello, Andrew. Yes, but sorry, your feed broke up there. The specific point you want me to address, could you just reiterate?
Yeah, so Operation Mobilise, it's about states of mind, and not for those just in uniform, but right across the piece, defence, government, even the nation. How can we, in supporting the army in Op Mobilise, and they're serious about it, and CGS tells us it's the main effort, hence a war game for the generalship program et al. How can we help the army to stimulate that change of mindset in defence, in government, in national attitudes? Is there anything we can do?
I think there is, and it's the fact that you've mentioned Op Mobilise specifically is quite pertinent, because we're doing a lot of work at the moment on Mobilise. The first thing that struck me about it, with having the conversations at our Land Warfare Centre, is, you know, the start state that we have for it, I think we're getting it slightly wrong, because there are at least a couple of years worth of lessons identified through various war games and the rest of it that seem to be discounted. And this is one of the problems I mentioned earlier about coherence, where all these different wargamings these wargaming activities have been conducted, but where is that repository that you were referring to earlier? Where is all this information, this knowledge being held? And you know, what I've found is that we are reinventing the wheel in a number of these instances here, because there are lessons that have been identified from some time ago, and we should be starting with looking at things like an Op Mobilise. What are the future force structures going to look like? How do we as the British Army configure ourselves to be able to fight in Europe? That have been learnt already, that have been put on a shelf somewhere, new staff officers have come in, that's all been forgotten about, and we're going back to stage one. So the first, I think, is helping the army, helping the armed forces by doing an analysis of all of this information, of trying to create that central repository of information and lessons identified from wargaming, but from other activities as well. Helping some of the new BCTs understand what they need to do in their validation pathways, for example. Wargaming has been done on that. A couple of years ago, I ran some war games, Des, you were involved in it with me, where we used the Camden Creeks Bill looking at survivability on the modern battlefield. There were some significant lessons learned there. That was, you know, nearly 3 years before the war in the Ukraine. And we were discovering there that our complete lack of drone capability and counter-drone capability meant that, and the way we conduct ourselves meant that our forces were being found and struck without even seeing the enemy. And those, what happened to those lessons? Where have they gone? Why are we relearning these lessons by observing what's going on in the Ukraine now? So I think, first of all, it's about helping to shape the thinking and cohere the information that's out there, creating that repository. Also, I think what is fairly critical is, and this is a personal observation, and I've seen it with a war game I did earlier this year at the Defence Academy, where a bold decision was made at the Defence Academy by the director of the High Command and Staff course to move to wargaming where the focus is Russia, looking at real-world situations, real-world scenarios, real-world adversaries, so that our staff officers, when they're doing these activities, are not wasting time, and in fact, the people who are designing the war games are not wasting time designing these false construct countries with backstories that are utterly irrelevant to the real world. Let's forget about whose sensibilities we may be affecting. In fact, surely there's an element of deterrence if we are designing war games to feed into things like op-mobilize that look at potential real-world adversaries. If you're that real-world adversary and you know that the UK armed forces, the US armed forces, NATO are planning to understand your capabilities and how to counter them, surely that is an element of deterrence as well. And then our staff officers will be developing an understanding of those potential real-world adversaries, but we should be incorporating that into the wargaming. So those bold decisions need to be made at that higher level. We need to be including and incorporating that. And, you know, then it's how we collaborate together. If we are informing things like op-mobilize across the wider defense, it needs to include all those multi-domain integration elements that Gordon was referring to. Excuse me. And we need to be working together. So if part of the organization is focusing down at the tactical level, so if Terry are running a lot of really tactical level exercises informing activities on OpCabrit, and we are supporting operational level decision making, looking at validation pathways to full operating capabilities, we should be talking together, because the lessons being learned at down at that tactical level should be carrying across to the operational level. And then likewise, if we're doing higher level strategic level wargaming, feeding it to SONAC, then these lessons should be carrying across, so that they're not being done in isolation. We all know the dangers of silos. So we shouldn't be doing that in the wargaming space either, because everything that we're doing is informing defense decision making. And I fear I may have rambled a little bit. Have I answered your question, Andrew, or have I gone off piste?
No, you're on piste, Ivor. You're on piste. You have answered the question. And actually, it strikes me there's quite a powerful thought in there. The messaging by what you do is really important. And maybe, Ben, when we come to your remarks at the end, maybe you could give us a view of some sort on that. Because countless times in my career in uniform, and plenty of times in my post-service career advising the service, I've been steered away from stuff like, we mustn't talk about Russia, we're trying to be friends with them at the moment, in 2016, for example. And as you say, conducting war games in imaginary countries with silly names, where actually, you know, doing the Guderian rehearsing the crossing of the Meuse 14 times until you've got it right might be a better thing to do than rehearsing crossing a fantasy river once or twice and then moving on. I think there's something very powerful in that particular thought. So thanks for that. Gordon, thoughts from you?
Yeah, I think that the feedback into Mobilize, from my point of view, is the best war game I ever did was during the Contested Urban Environment series, which is a Five Eyes program. We did it in Canada. And the really good thing is we had a shop floor where all the scientists brought their latest urban equipment. And we had a war game going upstairs with officers from the five officers in NCO, should I say, from the five nations there. And halfway through, we realized what the scientists were doing were in isolation to the military audience. So we invited the scientists to come up and give short briefs on their equipment and what they thought that equipment was for in the urban environment. And then we let the military people play with the equipment. And the scientists were going, we never imagined you'd use it for that. And what they imagined it for was sometimes not used and was sometimes, and it started to influence tactics and thinking on the ground and also back into the air as well with the ISR assets. And it went really well. And then the next time I saw that war game done and participated in, they'd upgraded all the scientific sort of technologies to take into consideration the military audience. And it was done at such an early stage, rather than they built a bit of kit and then handed it over to some people to train with. The process was so, and what was really clever, they captured the data. So they had the technology and they captured the data against it. And that went back into the scientific programs that were being worked on. And also identified a number of gaps. And that fed in perfectly. So that, again, on the next war game I saw, they produced ideas, technologies, capabilities to fill those gaps that come out of the war game. And I thought, but that was because there was enabled to be a series of war games and a break in between each one to allow the scientists to either adapt or capture. And then they, because they'd met military people, they were able to reach directly to those people. And then they brought it back into a controlled environment so people didn't sort of go rogue. And I think that was the best war game I ever saw, with scientists and military people sat together against a credible red threat. And again, going back to Ivor's point, we didn't even hide who the red threat was. We didn't make up some fictitious. It was more interested in getting to an urban environment and have some aims and objectives provided by a commander. In this case, was a one star. He stepped away and everybody moved ahead. And the scientists looked at the war game and then went, no, we've got this equipment. We could really help you do that. And that really improved. And we got some fantastic lessons back from that. Over.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. That's really interesting. And I was struck in CGS's remarks at the Roosieland Warfare Conference when he talked about the readiness of defence industry to step up to a different demand. He used the example of anti-tank weapons and said, you know, if we are rightly giving such a large part of our training stock to the Ukrainians to fight a real war, defence must be ready to step up and reprovide and backfill. And government must be ready to pay that bill so that we are backfilled and not just give away what we've got. And I guess that, you know, part of what you've just said is that your industry has got some really powerful messaging to do. And that, you know, we're on that case. We're ahead of you in a way that could really be leading as opposed to following. That's really useful. Thanks. Des, any thoughts?
What mobilises, I suspect, for me, certainly it's a bit like the Loch Ness Monster. I've heard about it, but I haven't actually seen it, so I'm a little unclear exactly what it is. But my thoughts are the Army's got 77 Brigade, which if we cannot use the good services of that organisation to get influence within defence, then I think we're perhaps missing a trick there. I know that they're establishing the Urban Centre of Excellence, and I know that because Soteria is involved, which is coming online. I think it's IOC is October, which is a project where they're looking at certainly running, I think, 4 or 5 war games a year, and then possibly some delivery out to units. And again, that I'm hoping will be against the peer threat. And my final thought is actually the work that John Spencer in his Urban Project podcast, you have a single subject enthusiast, if you like, but his reach and potential of spreading a message, he's very passionate about it. If you haven't heard him, go and listen. He says some interesting stuff. And that, to me, we need somebody of that ilk or a similar capability that will then drive wargaming in support of the Op Mobilise activity. And that's all I've got to say. Over.
Yeah, thanks, Des. Very interesting. I think particularly interesting for me is the All 77 Brigade comment. And it's one that is just worth reiterating for a moment, because it's one that I've heard made by the denizens of 77 Brigade often. The power of a large number of those people in 77 Brigade is often portrayed to the Army as what they bring in to the Army. You talk to lots of those people and they say, yeah, actually, we have much more power if we can take what the Army wants out into our other lives. And so, if nothing else, getting the message out, 77 Brigade is as good a source for that as anyone. Thanks, Des. I'm seeing questions mounting up 10 deep. Carl, some quick thoughts, and then Ben.
Yeah, thank you, General. My thoughts, you'll resonate with them in your role as Director Chaser. Clearly, there's two broad different types of war games. We have our data-driven war games, and then we have our decision support or facilitated form of wargaming. What we have with industry here is a body of trusted and competent organisations and people to provide objectivity. So that means that we can provide that positive contrarian role, avoid groupthink, and where suitable, we can move away from defence potentially to other nations where they might have experience, to history certainly, but also to civilian organisations who have had the same challenges, albeit slightly different, and integrate all of that into the military thinking. So by being a body of individuals that are paid for, they're normally listened to, but if we what we then say is of value, we can be of use.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. And I think those are three really good buzzwords, actually. So I'll just buzz them and then move on to Ben. But trusted, competent, objective, yes, absolutely. And by achieving those three things in relationship terms with the customer, you can absolutely be heralds for that message in a very, very positive way. Excellent. Bearing in mind that we want about half an hour for questions from the floor, Ben, over to you for a couple of minutes of your thoughts on all of that.
Okay, thank you. On mobilise, I think, you know, look, time may be very critical. From a traditional procurement approach, it just may not work at all. You know, thinking about what we want, how we're going to do it, you know, big platforms, big systems, we may not have the time. In fact, I don't believe we have the time. So we may need war games to really look at that challenge in what we invest in. And, you know, bear in mind some of those options around like comms, C2, ISR, and networks, you know, that sort of network centric warfare stuff have been talked about since 1997. And that's a quarter of a century ago. And we don't feel to be any closer. So, you know, can wargaming, I would feel that wargaming needs to be, well, people need to be thinking about how we can do it differently. Can war games show that we can best settle for in that area to support Operation Mobilize? I mean, there's a wider debate around buying new capabilities versus support and sort of readiness, but there's an awful lot of work there that will need to be done as you know as we start to get a better idea of how much money we actually have for defense in the later this year that'll do. The other point someone made, and I do understand it, a flip-flop, but in regards to changing scenarios and putting realistic names in, I'd really pause for thought. You know, we went out to Moscow and we sat there and listened to them, and they just banged on about World War II for 25 minutes to the point where we were sat there going, you know, what is this World War II you're talking about? They would love nothing more for them, their propagandists to be able to frame their illegal invasion of Ukraine as a NATO-Russia conflict for domestic propaganda purposes. You risk a very serious own goal if we actually hand them an opportunity to exploit that. I'm sure you've seen the late night TV shows they have. They would love it. They would absolutely love it, you to do that. And they can exploit and twist your work. Finally, in terms of, you know, what we talk about Mobilize in terms of, you know, I think we made the point around how Mobilize connects in with sort of wider national understanding, and you need that wider public support. One thing I have noticed over the last couple of years is that there have been a number of public war games that looked at potential events in the Baltics and Taiwan, and those definitely cut through. They cut through not just here, but they cut through, we noticed, in sort of wider media. They caught the public eye. And, you know, those sorts of things can nudge, you know, wider understanding in society. So they're often worth doing. So those are my points. Thank you very much.
Ben, thanks. I guess I'm scarred by my own experience. I'm so old that I grew up in the Cold War, and I served a large portion of the early part of my career up to and including subunit command during the Cold War. I would observe that the world in which I grew up was one that recognized, that genuinely recognized the threat, that you could stop anybody on the legendary Clapham omnibus and they would understand that priorities in various ways needed to be placed in various places because of the nature of the threat. We are no longer in that space at all as a nation. And I think a big bit of CGS's message was how do we get ourselves back into that state of realization that Strictly Come Dancing is not necessarily the most important thing that you might be giving your time to just now. And I do think that working out how we can all be part of, caveated in any way that you see fit, Ben, but working out how we can all be part of that messaging is going to be increasingly important, I think. I won't talk about historical cycles and periods of peace and all that sort of thing, but a casual glance at the last 2,000 years might give one or two leaders that make us think rather more heavily than we have been in the past. So.